Welcome to the SEO Insider with your host, Seth Price, founder of Blue Shark, taking you inside the world of legal marketing and all things digital.
Welcome, everybody. We are thrilled today to have Tony Wright, the co-founder and CEO of Wright IMC. Welcome, Tony.
Well, thanks for having me, Seth. I appreciate it.
You know, Tony, I've followed you for years. I've admired your sort of tenacity and both and as well as generosity within the agency community. I know that when there are issues online and somebody says, hey, how do you do this? You've been there, tried that, you know, made a mistake and always happy to share. And so for my personal growth as an agency owner, it's been great to have you out there. And I'm just thrilled we have a few moments to chit chat today.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I definitely wear my heart on my sleeve, I guess you might say.
Well, tell our audience a little bit about your story, because I know where you got to, but how did you get there?
Sure. Well, I started out in journalism, actually. Wanted to change the world, if you will, with writing, and took a job in newspapers right out of college. I loved it. It was great, but the pay was horrible. And I saw where the people that were where I wanted to be, how their lives were. And I decided that was just not for me. So I actually quit my journalism job and ended up getting a TA position at Texas Tech University, teaching journalism while I finished and got my master's degree in advertising. Turned out to be a great experience. Then I got a job at Weber Shandwick, which is the largest PR firm in the world. Running their on their digital team, and this was in like 99, so 98, 99. And at that time, if you actually understood HTML, you had every startup in the world offering you $200,000 if you were 21 years old. But I was lucky in that I was kind of well grounded, and I was like, okay, this is a good job. I'm not going to leave. But everybody else left, and so they put me in charge at 24. I was in charge of the global division of digital at Weber Shandwick, and I ran it for 8 years, up to a $20 million budget, and it was great. Eventually, they decided they weren't doing enough search for me, and that's kind of what I had fallen in love with, was search. Even, you know, we were doing everything from email blasts to, you know, building little websites, everything else. But I left through a couple of different things and started my own agency almost 14 years ago. I started out with just me in my garage. A buddy of mine who was doing marketing at Sherwin-Williams that I'd known from Texas Tech decided to come on board, John Confer. And he and I have been running this thing ever since. And we've been, you know, very, you know, I guess moderately successful, you know, able to have a nice living and pay for a lot of other people's living. So, you know, that's so kind of how it started.
That's awesome. You know, it's funny because I lived a parallel track on the legal side. And what I saw was I left big law in like 98 to join that first dot-com bubble where everything was. And so you saw people bailing out of law firms and like mid six figure jobs to go stake their fortune. And I think it's funny because one of the things that probably served you well is by not jumping ship and staying with one of the more traditional groups was that after 9/11 and, you know, the bubble had burst before that, that the world was all topsy-turvy. And to have a place where you didn't have to bounce around with a business model that worked, that's pretty neat that you got that experience at a time when a lot of people we're sort of scrambling. I sort of did a lot of sell. I had made a little bit of money during that first dot-com bubble, but not enough to retire, and sort of was like, okay, what do I do next? And that's similarly when I sort of pivoted with my knowledge from U.S. law, which was sort of my world. You know, you love search and I love this sort of legal local was my jam. So as you've built it up, you know, you seem to have touched many different, you know, you seem to have a smattering of different clients, which in one sense I'm sure is awesome because you don't get bored. But talk to me a little bit about the different sort of pulls and tugs of different type from national clients to local clients. How do you balance it, and what are sort of the strengths and weaknesses of having those types of people as clients?
Sure. The way that I feel about it, you know, I've had numerous consultants that I've talked with that like you need to focus on one vertical. The lesson that I learned is actually from my father, who ran an accounting firm in Dallas. He was a CPA for 55 years. When I was growing up, all he did was oil and gas CPA. He was a CPA for oil and gas.
Good spot to be doing it.
It was good until about 1986.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And he went from having 65 employees to down to less than 5 in 4 months.
Wow.
I watched that happen as a kid and watched my dad have to pivot. And he was able to pivot. He pivoted to healthcare. It took him a little while, obviously. After that, even though he kind of was, you know, majority healthcare, he maintained clients in lots of
different firms. He diversified.
Diversified. For me, we've had some practice areas. We've talked about verticalization, but frankly, every time I'm thinking about where do we want to verticalize, I watch the market dip in that area, it seems like. And so we've been very successful, and actually, you know, I have had, I love big clients, but I like having, you know, $32,000 a month clients. Because when someone leaves, you don't feel it.
Well, absolutely. And that's, it's so funny because, again, parallel lives, I'm not diversified as far as subject matter. And, you know, in one sense, with legal, we have sort of the big hit that's taken, you know, hospitality and travel and all of that has not hit there. So I get the diversification. I'm sure like there were markets that you had that you're going to have to make up some revenue, but it's a percentage, not a whole thing. But that's so funny you talk about that, because that's true whether it's you're a law firm and not having one client that makes or breaks you, or as an agency, very similarly, that, you know, when you start getting to those higher dollars that can make your month or quarter, it changes the dynamic and the client relationship, I think, to a certain degree. It's great to have the revenue. When you have it, it's awesome. But it's one of those things that can be pretty stinging if it goes south.
Yeah, probably one of the worst days that I've ever had as an agency owner was when we lost our large, you know, $40,000 a month client. And the thing was, is it wasn't just one day though, because I could see they were, you know, slipping. They were slipping. You know, over the, you know, 3 or 4 months, it's like, okay, we got a new marketing manager. This guy's not quite as friendly as the last one, you know, and you're seeing that. And the stress that led up to that, because I knew that when they left, you know, no matter what, we were going to have to lay some folks off. And I hate doing that.
Well, let me ask you something that I have struggled with. So again, I'm giving you mine just as a point of comparison. So I spun out of Blue Shark, which was one of the law firm, a division for lower dollar people, right? Mm-hmm. And SEO for lawyers has one price point. And there's a lot of labor that goes into building content and links and, you know, technical, et cetera. But there was clearly a market that was in the $1,000-$2,000 range that wasn't being served. And I was concerned that with volume comes opinions and just, you know, unhappy clients, you know. So on the law side, you know, there are people who like get rid of those low dollar clients. They're the biggest pains and they cause the most problems for the least money. You know, yes, it's great to have $32,000 clients, but my guess is a lion's share of complaints come from that department, mm-hmm. just statistically. So how do you, on a couple levels, one from a reputation management point of view, I'm curious your analysis. And secondly, when you're used to dealing with Mac Daddy clients that have they're paying for and have a certain expectation, one of my fears internally was making sure that resources are not disproportionately placed on lower dollar clients, because you hire people who have to be able to service the higher dollar clients who are badass. And not that you don't want badass people with your $2,000 clients, they're thrilled to have it. But for you to be profitable, there has to be a moderate amount of resources put, otherwise you'll be upside down. How do you balance that?
Well, that's the way we're built is, again, you find people that disagree with this. Everything we do is time and materials. Everything we do is hourly. I mean, we're a law firm basically. So it's $160 an hour, whatever client that is being worked on, whether that client is paying me $30,000 a month or $2,000 a month. So the client that's 12 and a half hours at $2,000 a month is getting 12 and a half hours.
Right. So you're keeping, it's almost more important to keep your staff honest than it is anything else. You could in theory, and like I've worked off a flat fee model, which I'm happy with because I know there are ups and downs and I have to get the job done. But our buddy, Mike Ramsey, who just had a nice exit.
Yes, he did. You know,
he has talked repeatedly, and he's one of the guys in the legal space unique to follow your model because it's one of the easier ways to scale because you know you're not going to get hurt. If you need more resources, you pay more money or you don't get it.
I've done it both ways, and I can tell you from my perspective, the hourly rate works much better for me as far for everything, for hiring, because I can create a capacity report and know exactly how many hours that we have to give out to work and then know how many hours that we have scheduled to work each month. So I can sit there and look when I get to 85 to 90% capacity, that's when it's time to start hiring. The thing is that I start getting whining from my team starts complaining at about 65% capacity. Oh, we're going to need help. We're going to need work. And I can look and show them the numbers. This is where we're at. This is when we can hire. And they all know it. We go over capacity every single week.
So what is capacity? What capacity do you have to be at?
We will start looking for a position and start looking for what the position is once we hit 80%. Because you can move pretty quick up to 80 to past 100. I mean, that takes just a couple clients, you know.
Funny, because I know the legal billable world, but I'm less more of a novice on this. What do you consider full capacity for? Like, how many hours a day are your people bowling eight? Do they have a certain?
I have 30 billable hours a week. Yep. 30 billable hours a week, because that I figure that there's 10 hours of work that you need to be doing. Actually, it's more than that, you know, but nobody works a 40 hour week.
If they do, they may work the 40 hour week, but it's not a billable 40 hour week.
Sure.
Internal meetings and things like that, you
right.
know, business and development.
Research, but that gives us 10 hours of, and business development, that's, you know, my team really doesn't do a lot.
It depends on the person. I'm just saying, whatever it is, it may be a project they're doing. It could be a speculative thing. It's so funny as you look at different industries, because in the legal space, when you're at mega firms, they expect closer to 40 hours a week, 2000 hours a year for the mega firms where they're at. Now they charge, they pay big money and people work a lot more than 40 hours a week to get that, right? They're working 50 to get their 40. But you know, it's funny because most of the business consumer world, the people like family law, trust and estates, that is essentially what they're billing is 1500 hours a year, which is what your 30 hours, a week is, because that's a human amount. It gives you a 40 hour week minus breakage, so to speak.
Right. And I mean, when I was at Weber, it was the same basic model. But we were expected to bill 40 hours a week.
Understood. But you also didn't, you know, you worked weekends, you worked nights.
Oh,
that
exactly.
was part of the culture.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's much harder. And they're also paying, I don't know about there, but in general, the law firms that expect those numbers generally are paying at a much higher number that incentivizes somebody to do that.
Exactly. And you know, I saw that my brother is an attorney and he was at a larger law firm and he's now a partner in a smaller firm that, you know, business law. And the reason he will tell you that the reason that he doesn't do that anymore is because he has kids and he wants to see them.
Exactly. And if you're billing 2000 to 2200 hours a year, you're missing a lot of stuff. You're working till 8 o'clock every night minimum. And you are nights and weekends beyond that. It's not nothing. So interesting. So with this gives you more transparency for you to see but the issue I assume is if you lose a big client, it is you know you have those hours, you either resell the hours to somebody else or you have to, you know, figure something out.
Right. And I, you know, I, my guys know, I've said, if, you know, if you're sitting there and you're only billing 10 to 15 hours a week, then you might need to be getting a little bit concerned about your job.
Right. And it just felt, you know, but it's better than, you know, again, I admire that because I wouldn't have as much, there's a definitive metric for you.
Yes.
Again, you have the flip side is somebody is filling the hours but not providing value. That's a whole nother story, and you have to have your own internal KPIs to make sure that's not happening. Let's talk about the sausage making a little bit. You know, when we started this thing, you know, I can speak for myself. I was sitting there, and to me, it was the art of finding links, of getting high quality content up there, et cetera. As you've scaled, talk to me a little bit about the process of scaling what was inside of your noggin into an expanded team across multiple different industries.
Sure. It can be difficult, but we have a process whereby, you know, the first, and this is one of the reasons that I also like the hourly model. It goes back to that is what I do is I tell a client, you know, this is your, it basically works as a retainer. So you get X amount of hours from my team's time to do whatever is needs to be done. So we sit down with each client once a month and go over what the priorities are for the next month. So we always have kind of a list, and we use Asana, you know, a list of everything that needs to be done.
We love Asana.
And so we have, so we'll have these task lists that are made every month. And those, we have we call them account owner that assigns those to whoever needs to do them. We try to assign them based upon interest, based upon how well someone can do something. It doesn't always work that way. But like, for instance, we just got a new client that is really interested in high value, almost like Wall Street Journal style links. That's a totally different program than the guy that I was just working on before I got on here, which is an electrician with 10 offices in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. You know, he doesn't need links, very many links at all. So, but what we've done there is I've got people assigned to creating those relationships with those other folks. And I've kind of, I'm helping supervise that. Whereas the electrician, I will talk to the guy to sell him, and then I probably won't even talk to him anymore. And it tends to work out, you know. I work with the team once a quarter. I get together, we start talking about, okay, what's the next hire we need to make? Like, we just did this actually. And the next hire we need to make, we've got to get another writer on board. You know, that's our, as soon as I get to capacity, that's what we're going to be looking at, 'cause that's where the majority of the time is being spent. And I can look at the reports and see what kind of tasks are being done. We're cross training the team across the board all the time. Always, you know, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so you don't have, like, again, my world with local search, we're so focused on local search. You know, everything is content, doesn't mix with links, doesn't mix with local. They're each its own little fiefdom. You have people that might be doing content one day and link building the next. Is it just,
yes,
you're all around talent that you believe in that could, they can multitask?
I believe in hiring people that can be cross-trained.
Right.
I've done the siloing my entire career. When I was at Weber Shandwick, it was funny. It was like, we can't do that. That's advertising. And what was funny is I was in the same building as Timberland McLean, TM. And I ended up working for both of them because I was straddling that fence of advertising and PR. And I always thought it was silly how there were lines drawn in the sand for those types of things. And sometimes it's even hard to understand, okay, is internal link building? Are we trying, you know, how are we classifying this? And you start getting into, when a lot of times I found when we get into that, that's not my job, which that is probably the biggest curse word you could say at my agency. Anybody who ever tells me that's not my job, they're probably not going to last at my agency very long.
That's awesome. One of the things that I mentioned at the beginning that I really enjoyed following you online was you do wear stuff on your sleeve. Talk to me about some of the sort of some of the biggest sort of mistakes. I find we can learn a lot, and you've sort of shared some, but what are some of the things you're like, man, if I had known this 10 years ago, this would have made this journey that much easier?
There's been some, I found that hiring based upon personality is much better than hiring based upon skill set. There's been some high profile hires we've made, I guess, people that, you know, you would think would be amazing that just didn't work out either because of ego or they were not quite as advertised. I would much rather have hired somebody who I can train. That's a big one. And I actually, I'm big on personality tests.
That was my follow-up question. So which ones do you like?
I like culture. We use Culture Index, which I found to be extremely accurate. Once you understand it, you have to kind of, they give you training and you have to go through it and you have to really understand it. It's not, you know, you can't just pick it up. It's not like a, you know, Myers-Briggs where you can just kind of understand it. You really need to understand what the dots mean and how that works. But I really, since we've done that, either every single time we've hired somebody and gone against what the Culture Index told us, it's turned out to be a mistake. So that's,
and yet we still do it. But
you know, no, well, they're you know what? I'm horrible at it. I'll fall in love with a candidate.
Well, and that's something that I've sort of talked about on this show and others, you know, the idea of the idea that there are people who interview well and there are people that are good employees. And that has been sort of, I think, something that I've put, you know, all the truisms, hire slow, fire fast, you know, all that stuff. Great. On a recent podcast, I know it was this one, talking to Jack Newton, who founded Clio, and they have like 500 plus employees. And he was really big on the backdoor references, that they ignore the references they're given, and their job is to find out who the person is. And I think it's part of this, which is, you know, if you're in an organization, the thing that I sort of came to grips with early on was that in my market, DC, there are so many nonprofits, associations, think tanks, that if you have SEO on a resume, you can get a six-figure job. You may know nothing about SEO. And so for me, I was unable to hire at a cost-effective rate anybody with talent locally. And that the only way I could do it would be to bring people in and train them up, not just because it was cost-effective, but because I would be paying for somebody who didn't even know what they were doing at the higher level. And that's sort of what sort of created our process. You know, have you over the years brought in lateral talent, or is it mostly homegrown talent that you've put your thumb on?
We have brought in some, and it's typically someone that either really fits the profile, or we've had actually some success bringing in people that I know. Like,
well, it's right. So that helps. You're very influential in the circuit. I assume you get to know people over time, and that's one less. Again, it always changes once they're in the door, but at least you have one good touch point.
Right. I mean, we just, you know, one of my the guy who was pretty much almost my COO, for 8 years, he actually left us because he semi-retired, moved out to the country. But he actually now is working for one of our clients. But he was one of my good friends from college. And then he worked at American Airlines and was my client there when I was working with them. So that's the example of the type of person, you know, and I've hired people that I've known from, you know, the circuit, or people that I've known over the years that I think could do the work.
Trust is so much of it.
Yeah, no, there's one girl that is a good friend, good family friend. Our kids are the same age. I've hired her 3 times, and then she keeps quitting because she wants to be a stay-at-home mom. And then I get into some sort of pickle, and I'm like, Carrie, can you come back for a little while? And you know, and I'll hire her again because I know whatever I throw at her, she can get it done.
That's awesome.
But there's, you know, but most of the people that, you know, we hire are either younger or career changes. You know, I don't like to just say we hire younger people, because we just hired someone who made a career change, who was a realtor for 20 years, you know, but is great with clients.
You know, with this whole pandemic and the idea that we're all, at least in our market, everybody's working from home, have you seen a shift in mentality? Are you now willing to go nationally, whereas before you wouldn't? Talk to me about that.
Absolutely. It's actually been, that's probably been the biggest change for us. You know, in March, there was one day I just finally looked at around the office that we had, this big office. I said, okay, everybody work from home until I say no. Everybody left. We all worked from home, and actually, I was so scared of it, and it worked.
I couldn't agree more.
Everybody was doing their job. And
now, whether this is going to last year two is another story. Right. But one of the pieces, and I don't know if you've had this, but internal drama is something that I've seen in multiple different iterations of my business life, particularly with some younger employees, even older employees. And that is the one thing we may lose. We've lost commute times and we've lost internal drama. There may be other issues, but those two things I'm not going to miss.
Exactly. Yeah. We got really lucky because somebody wanted to sublet our place. And so I said, take it. And I got a little virtual office and we have conference rooms if we need them, but I don't know what's going to happen in a year. We can move back into an office if we need to, but we actually have now hired two people that are not in Dallas.
Right. And my guess is most people are moving in that direction. I'm old school. I'd love to have the people there, but again, they're not in Dallas, but they can fly in for trainings and they're going to be as productive. Thankfully technology is there. There's software that sort of monitors. As a business owner, there's that fear. Am I completely getting ripped off?
That $8,000 a month in rent that I don't have to pay is a pretty good salve for.
Yeah. But to me, first of all, our rent's higher, is even higher for less space, I'm sure. Yeah. But that said, I don't mind. To me, rent has always been one of those things that I don't say it's a good thing, but it has always been a stabilizing factor. When you started, again, if you think back, I'm on the digital side a lot, not as far along, but when there's a physical place where there, and again, we have national clients. I don't even have local clients. That's how inept my business model is, in the sense that I don't have local clients for the most part, very, very few, because we don't want to have the conflict with our law firm. So all of our clients come from around the country. But having that facility that people come to and feel a part of, there is something to it. I've had to cut it out with this recent surge, but the idea of sitting down outside the office, socially distant with the people, when you hire people that have never been to your office before, it's kind of it's trippy, right? I mean,
Yeah, that's a little bit what I am worried about over time. I mean, we've only had a few hires since the pandemic that I'm, even with those guys, what I've been doing is doing one-on-one Zooms with them, kind of Zoom lunches once a week. And until I get, feel like I know them a little bit. Because in the office, I would just walk over to their desk and talk to them. But
walk over to Starbucks with them, at least you could get a lot of one-on-one time.
Right.
And it's easier when it's physical. It takes more thought, and again, in one sense it shouldn't be. I don't know if they're getting rid of it, but I love the Google Hangout. Everybody's on Slack person, but the idea that you're just on your email and you push a button, the person's there. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a underutilized piece.
Yeah, I wish they hadn't started allowing backgrounds, because now my guys are all doing weird stuff and
that should be our biggest issue. To me, it's making sure that people are on camera and engaged. I have three kids Zooming school right next door, and thankfully they haven't interrupted us too badly. But I have to yell at them to stay on Zoom. They're like, well, what's the difference? I'm like, the teacher's there, you want to be engaged. They have a whole setup with an extra chair and a blanket, and they're sort of like in a lie flat first class seat. And I'm like, no, feet on the ground with the camera on. If you're not engaged and active, it is very easy to sort of fall out of that. Because part of it is, our clients are counting on us to get stuff done. And if that level of intensity is not there, you're not going to be as productive as when it is.
Absolutely. I mean, there definitely is a mindset. And I think we'll see, after hopefully the pandemic ends in the near future, and then we can make decisions. I worry about some of my clients and friends in commercial real estate. What's going to happen? I don't know. They're all actually optimistic, but I think that there's definitely I don't see how there's not going to be a trend to going more virtual.
And like anything, I'm sure it'll trend. And we've seen some people, take Yahoo, for example, they went to that and zoomed back. Now, is that Yahoo or is it a defective business model? That was there, But I think what we have seen, at least short term, is there's some huge benefits. And if that is in fact the case, you know, our wish coming out of this for the agency would have like a clubhouse, you know, with a couple offices. You need an office, have a conference room, and have some places like hotel style. But do you need people in the office every day? There are a lot of advantages of it. There's a serendipity that happens within those four walls. I love the idea of being able to hire nationally, and I think it's going to be some sort of a blend. But whatever that blend is, it's not going to be at the same point we are now. We're not going back to this point. So whether it's commercial real estate's down 10, 20, or 50%, jury's still out, but the genie's not going back in the bottle.
No, I agree with that. Yeah. Definitely cool. Going to be virtual. So, yeah.
So any thoughts? You know, we have a whole, you know, the people listening, you know, I've gotten to hear you from stage many, many times. Right now, what are the two or three things as we conclude that are sort of you're seeing in the digital space that you're putting assets towards that you think are moving the needle currently?
Well, I know, you know, since you're big and local, I've been really evaluating. We've been utilizing for reviews management a number of different tools. And I don't know what you're using, but, you know, we've been big fans of GatherUp because I like them I like the way that they're creating a process as opposed to kind of trying to manipulate things or, you know, I don't mind like the trust pilots of the world and stuff, but it feels a little bit like that could become an issue down the road.
Plus you're building reviews somewhere else. And again, based on the industry, and look, there was a point when those trust pilots were getting you stars you couldn't get otherwise. Exactly. Like the little games, like if there's a third reason, but you know, Mike Blumenthal was a recent guest and I'm a huge fan of his from day one. So it's not surprising, you know, in our space, there are about four or five like GatherUp that are really quite good. And we've stayed agnostic as far as, you know, our clients have their favorites and it's not like a gym membership. They're all great if you use them. You know, it's like, you know, you could be at a $10 a month gym. And so, but I think what you're saying is, hey, reviews are key. You got to have some finite strategy behind it and not just have it happen.
Right. It's been surprising to me how many people have been coming in the door that have absolutely no review strategy.
Right.
And so that's a big one on the local side. On the, on the SEO side, it's pretty much, you know, it's the same old as far as, you know, building, call it the five C's, you know, the code of the site, the content of the site, the connections, which are the links, the communication, which is the social, and then we call it capture, which is the data on the analytics side. I'm tired of SEMrush and Google Analytics changing their interfaces because I'm old and I can't find things. But other than that, you know, I've been really happy with kind of the tool sets as they're evolving. I like the fact that, you know, we've been able to really hit in with some great tools and some dashboarding and even become, I'm really big on transparency with my clients. Now, sometimes transparency can get you into trouble and sometimes clients just don't care.
Well, they don't care, but there's also ebbs and flows.
Right.
And, you know, we have times where Google isn't loving something, whether it could be, you know, they're just ups and downs. We don't, you know, we're not soothsayers.
Well, I always say that I'm not, you know, we're not, if somebody comes to me and say, I've had this a million times, hey, could you work with us for 6 months and train my team on how to do this? And I say, well, we're not a training company, but we will educate you on what you're seeing. And we'll make it so that you can go in and look at, you know, and we're not going to tell you, try to make it look better. We're going to say, here's the dashboard. Here's the data. You can go in and make your own interpretations. And now we'll argue over time about what's good, what's bad, et cetera. But that has been, I think, some of the dashboarding, the stuff we've been doing with Google Studio, and, you know, obviously, on the paid side, I could talk about that for hours and hours. Some of the rises in programmatic, what we're seeing in some of the new shopping feeds, some of the new ad units that Google's running out, Facebook, you know, what we're seeing on that. Facebook is driving me a little crazy with their targeting going, you know, back and forth. But it's still working. We're still seeing great results from it. So, you know, it's, I think the biggest thing for me is what can I do to be transparent and education and educate my clients so they can understand what's going on. And then what's the value of the newest thing that I need to be making sure. I don't want to be cutting edge, but we don't also don't want to be laggards.
So fun. That's been my philosophy there. You know, if you had given $2,000 to every guy who was doing geofencing, you would be very poor. And, you know, it's like, meaning every single guy came along and said, I got to see, it's going to be on the special app and this and that. It's nonsense. We're getting closer and closer, but it's never quite been, you know, at least in the local space, it's always some guy who used to work at Yodel who's going to now make his money with a geofencing company.
Right.
That's been the pattern.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And so it goes to your point, like you don't want to be behind the curve, but I also don't want to put valuable resources towards something that is experimental. You know, I'm happy to experiment on my own dime and test stuff at my law firm as an incubator for others. But I really, you know, if, as you know, our clients hold us such a high standard that when you go too risky for people, X number of percent of the time, it's not going to work. And then you're left with this thing where you've spent X number of hours and you don't have that value to show.
Exactly. Well, that's also some of the reasons, like for instance, I'm a huge, huge believer in CRO and conversion rate optimization. And my team knows the basics and we're, you know, good. We can usually improve, but when I have a client that really needs some CRO, I have partners that I go to. When I have a client that needs affiliate marketing, I don't do that. I've got, you know, so
right, you have your go-to people.
Yes, I have people that I will go to for that, and I'm not going to invest in hiring the people on my team, or, you know, to come on my team to, because I've got really great partners. There's no reason for me to employ those people, especially when we haven't sold it before. And I don't know if we're going to be able to sell it in the future.
Well, it's like anything else. And if you had 20 clients who all demanded it, you'd figure it out. Right. But it sounds like you have the benefit of diversity and the sort of great thing that gets you out of bed, that there's everything is new and different, but you know, it's making sure that you put some blinders on the side so that anything beyond that you're getting some help on.
Exactly. I learned a long time ago to stay, just try, even though we're, you know, we're not having vertical specific, definitely the more I stay in my lane, the better off I am.
That's awesome. Well, Tony, this has been awesome. I'm sure we could talk for hours and wanted to thank you so much for your time today. And just over the years, everything that I've sort of gleaned just from both the stage and from social, you're definitely very generous. And I hope we get to return the favor sometime soon.
Thank you, Seth. I appreciate you having me on.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for tuning in to the SEO Insider with Seth Price. Be sure to check back next week for fresh insights into building your brand's online presence. Episodes are available to stream directly on Blue Shark Digital's website.